I added that Marta had been given a precious gift, her psychic talent of receptivity, that it had been a scary experience this first time but that with more maturation and training it would become a controlled valuable talent, a God-given gift to be used for good, but that for the present she was simply to wait and let it grow, and eventually she would be shown what her next stage should be. I asked that a spiritual guardian be sent to protect and guide her during this growth period. A few weeks later she told me that at first her guardian was with her constantly, helping her whenever she called him, her to assist with simple things, but that lately there had been no response. I smiled and reminded her that a guardian was not a sort of bellhop to assist with minor earthly problems but is a high spiritual being dedicated to spiritual protection and instruction. 25. After Marta and her mother had gone, I could not get the episode out of my mind. Something seemed to be incomplete. I wondered if the voice had come from a being who was truly concerned for the safety of someone named Lorna Jasek. Who was Lorna Jasek? Marta did not know anyone by that name, nor did I. I looked in the telephone directory. Yes, there were two Jaseks listed. After thinking about the embarrassment of calling an unknown person with a message like this, I realized that my own hesitation was of far less importance than the delivery of the message which had seemed so urgent to the owner of the voice that had burst into Marta's consciousness. So the next morning I called the first Jasek and calmly asked if Lorna was there. No, she's at work, answered the person on the other end just as calmly. Aha, there was a Lorna Jasek. I called the work number and asked for Lorna. She just came in. I'll get her, said the person on the phone. Next was a second voice, this is Lorna. Trying not to stammer, I introduced myself, complete with title doctor and my location, and then began, I think I have a message for you, but I'm not sure. And I told her the story as told above. She listened silently. When I finished I added rather apologetically, I don't want to upset nor worry you but I thought at least you ought to know. She thanked me and agreed that she was glad to know and was not upset. She asked who the girl was who had received the message. You don't know her and she doesn't know you, I hedged. We didn't even know whether you existed. Oh, I exist, laughed Lorna. I was relieved to know that she could laugh about it. The next day the phone rang and a man's voice introduced himself as Lorna's uncle and asked about this message that I had given to his niece. Again, with apologies, I repeated the story, adding that I just didn't know, but had thought maybe it might be important. Without hesitation he said, it is important. We are planning to drive several hundred miles tomorrow. What do you think we ought to do? Trying to keep my mind clear, I suggested, well, just be alert and drive defensively, and keep in mind that a drunk or a careless person may suddenly come out of a side road or cut across in front of you. He thanked me and then asked if I knew whose voice had been speaking to his niece. I said I had not asked, but afterward I had wondered if it were Lorna's grandmother. Is one of her grandmothers dead? I inquired. There was a slight pause before he said, yes. He thanked me again and hung up. Only later did I realize it may have been his own mother whose voice had come through. I spent considerable time afterward wondering if I had done my part wisely. Perhaps I should have advised postponing the trip, or had I taken the whole incident too seriously? I simply did not know. Nor did I ever know how Lorna and her uncle got along on their trip. I did know that if more such cases were to be tossed into my path I would need to get more instruction. Next step, more learning in California. In 1985 I found a 2-hour workshop offered by William Baldwin, DDS and PhD candidate, which gave me the techniques I needed to treat such cases more adequately for both the client and also the invisible personalities. Baldwin called his workshop Depossession in the Clinical Setting, that is, not a religious setting but a health worker's setting. Starting with this workshop, and adding several of Baldwin's tapes from previous workshops, I began a little home course in the recognition and treatment of cases of obsession and depression, a sort of self-taught crash course in modern exorcism, one might call it. I procured and eagerly read an old book that I had first heard about years ago when I was in my early 20s. 30 Years Among the Dead, by the psychiatrist Carl Wicklund. He had performed hundreds of depossessions at the turn of the last century, using his psychically talented wife, Anna, with her willing cooperation, as the channel for the entities obsessing his psychiatric patients. His book was first published in 1924 and reprinted in 1974. Baldwin was influenced by Wicklund's firm but kindly approach to the invading personalities and modeled his own approach after Wicklund's. I also read Annabelle Chaplin's book, The Bright Light of Death, 1977, the account of some of her cases of assisting personalities entrapped in living individuals to leave their unwitting hosts and go on into the light. Chaplin avers that she never in her life was in a trance, but her description of her method, including taking a moment to center herself or to quiet herself equivalent to placing herself into an altered state of consciousness, produces what many might call a trance. The words chosen are not important, it is the altered state of awareness that is important. In this quiet state, Chaplin opened her natural psychic ability to perceive clairvoyantly what in ordinary consciousness she might have only vaguely sensed. Her approach to the invading entities, like Wicklund's, was gentle but clear-cut and firm. It was a psychologist, Dr. Edith Farr, author of The Unquiet Dead, who recommended Chaplin's book to Baldwin, and like Edith he was influenced by Chaplin's mild way of treating the invading personalities. I read other books. They are listed in the bibliography. I attended Dr. Farr's all-day workshop on clinical depossession. And all this time I was beginning what rather quickly became a considerable portion of my hypnotherapy practice, the releasement of obsessing souls from living patients. Releasement is Baldwin's word. I prefer it to depossession, disobsession, or exorcism, terms used by various other therapists for this process. It was an easy step to begin to do rescue work with wandering entities who had not invaded living persons, work with so-called ghosts, poltergeists, and invisible presences, most of whom need help to escape from their unhappy situations. I felt that my new occupation was one of the most fascinating in the world, and was valuable to others as well. Terms and definitions. What shall we call disembodied souls like Maggie? Her physical body was buried, but some part of her was seen and recognized by her daughter and was felt to be alive and able to understand conversation, even to resist suggestions. Some of the therapists doing releasements speak of the spirit of a deceased person which can be contacted and which clairvoyants can see. Others say the word spirit to mean the divine incorruptible spark in the person, which is housed in the soul as the soul is housed in the body, to quote from Mary's message to the world. The word soul being used to mean the mental and emotional and perceptive portions of a person which persist as a unit after the death of the physical body, housed in a body of invisible astral substance. 29. Maggie as seen by Amy was in her astral body, the usually invisible organized body of emotional energies that survives death along with the mind and its mental body. The state of hypnosis expanded Amy's ordinary powers of perception to include astral vision and clairvoyance so that she could see astrally. If her mother had been willing to speak, Amy could have heard her clairaudiently. As it was, Maggie did become willing to send her thoughts telepathically into Amy's mind so that Amy was aware of what her mother was thinking, thinking of all the cherished things that Maggie had to leave and now wanted to regain as her own again through co-occupying her daughter's body. But that meant pushing aside her daughter's own soul, personality, spirit, even pushing it clear out of her daughter's body unethical selfish acts, although Maggie had not bothered to consider the ethics. For myself, I like the term psyche to mean that mental/emotional/spiritual part of a person that survives death. But I admit that it becomes boring to use the word too often. Personality is almost as good, as is soul, mind, or consciousness, with the implicit inclusion of perceptiveness and emotion. I shall use these terms interchangeably, and also spirit, in the sense that Baldwin and members of the spiritualist church use it as the living mind housed in the usually invisible astral body. I say usually invisible because persons in hypnosis and those who have a natural talent for astral vision, also called clairvoyance or second sight, can see the astral forms as if they were physically visible. Second sight is a term also used to mean precognition, the awareness of future events. Among the gradually increasing number of hypnotherapists who do releasement work at present, it has become accepted to use the all-inclusive word entity for souls that are being contacted and assisted. Each of us is an entity, of course, as is each other individual being. 30. When hypnotherapists speak of an entity, however, they usually mean the soul of a deceased person or other invisible being that is entrapped in a living person or is causing problems in other ways. Normal and abnormal pathways of souls after death. When clients are regressed to a previous life and come to the death experience terminating that lifetime, therapists may continue the regression past the physical death and on into the after-death state. Similarly, when we contact earthbound entities, souls like Maggie, for instance, we can ask them to recall the circumstances of their physical death experiences. Normally, after the physical body dies, the psycho-spiritual part, the mind, the psyche, the soul finds itself floating above the body, still conscious of itself and aware of the people and activities around the dead body. This stage may be brief. The now disembodied consciousness, usually feeling free and light and greatly relieved, senses that it can go wherever it seems to be drawn, for instance to a light perceived to be alive and sentient, a being of light which welcomes the personality with understanding, kindness, and love. Most souls FMD themselves going to a state that is peaceful and beautiful. People who have had out-of-body experiences during a time of life-threatening danger or illness, or who have actually been pronounced dead and been resuscitated later, most often have reported visiting the beautiful realms. Only an occasional such person reports a chilly, lonely, or horrifying near-death experience. NDE, obsession is the condition, remarkably common, in which the entity may invade not only the psyche but also the physical body of the host and meld its own personality traits and former bodily feelings with those of the host, often to the confusion and bewilderment of the latter, who may be aware of persistent pains, sudden changes in emotions unlike his normal feelings, unfamiliar attitudes, or even unnatural traits and talents. Possession is the condition in which the invading entity takes over the body of the host completely, pushing out the host's own personality, soul, and expressing its own words, feelings, and behaviors through the host's body, as Maggie was apparently trying to do to Amy. Complete possession is rare, but is sometimes spectacular when it occurs. Cases of a person suddenly going berserk, for instance, may well be cases of sudden complete possession. Possession may alternate with obsession. I have seen personally only one instance of complete possession so far. It occurred without warning in my own therapy room, as described in detail in a later chapter. What conditions make such invasions possible? Let us assume that a group of people, such as battle casualties or a group killed in a plane crash, are all deprived of their physical bodies at the same time, and their souls FMD themselves conscious but without a means of communication with persons still in living bodies. These souls may feel stunned for a little while, but some are soon aware enough to see their bodies. They seem to be floating above the scene, and they watch what is going on. 34. Usually with more or less impersonality toward their former body. But, as they so often tell us, I didn't know what to do, I didn't know where to go. Those who see the light and move toward and into it FMD the normal pathway into the next world, the astral world. The others wander away. Some may be attracted to persons who are smoking, drinking, or using drugs. If they themselves have been users of those substances, they feel that they can satisfy their hungers through the bodies and senses of the living, and so they move into the smokers or drinkers or drug users. Others find and become attached to a living person whose aura is weak or open, as after an accident, an illness, an anesthetic for an operation, a sudden physical shock or pain, or an emotional shock such as fear or grief, The aura in health is a strong defense, a protection for the psyche within the body, but in weakness it can be breached by an invading soul. Still other disembodied psyches in this group find living persons who resemble themselves in some way, either psychologically or in environmental conditions. The similarity draws them into the host. A soul released from the body by a heart attack, for example, may enter a living person whose heart is feeble, making the condition still worse for the host. A soul who died filled with anger from any cause is attracted to a living angry person, entering and increasing the host's anger. Still other souls may find themselves drawn to living persons whom they admire or who may give them a safe home, or whom they even feel they can help and protect, although almost always such a selfless motive on the part of the invader contains a self-serving element somewhere. One more class of invaders is that of souls who have had a close relationship with the living person in some past time, either in the present life or in a past existence. Either for 35, love and friendship, or else for hatred and revenge, such souls may find themselves teamed up in an obsessive relationship. Maggie and her daughter Amy provide a good example of obsession, not quite the complete possession that Maggie was apparently trying to establish. After all these reasons for the formation of an obsessive relationship have been tallied, one more is simply that the living person happened to be there at the time when the wanderer happened by. No one seems to be totally invulnerable. Living persons who work in the health profession are vulnerable to obsession by deceased souls because they are caring people and souls feel safe in them. Children, whose auras are not yet fully protective, are also vulnerable. And it was an invading entity who remarked that the unborn child in utero is the most vulnerable of all. What can we do to prevent obsession or to get rid of an entity? In general, we need to keep our aura clear, clean, and strong with healthy habits of all kinds: physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional. Asking deliberately in prayer for spiritual protection is visualizing a protective capsule or bubble of light surrounding one's body and aura is good. Monitoring one's inner thoughts and feelings is essential, too, lest corrosive angers or fears open the aura. Meeting the daily vicissitudes with calmness and strength, making a habit of positive attitudes of mind and heart and positive habits of speech, all these help to keep the aura strong and clear. If the presence of an invading entity is suspected as after the death of a close friend or relative, then the person can talk directly to the deceased and 36, assist the obsessing soul to leave and move into the light. More will be said about this later. But what about dealing with an oppressing or obsessing entity that is already attached to the host person? The process of expelling an invader used to be confrontive and angry, a sort of power struggle between the exorcist and the invader, whether the exorcist, therapist, was the host or a professional healer or clergy person. Some who felt themselves shadowed or harassed or otherwise negatively influenced by something not in accord with their own character have suspected an obsessing entity, and by meditations and prayer have been able to perform their own personal exorcism. In one case that I contacted, however, the entity had been expelled only as far as the outer portion of the woman's aura and still clung there, no doubt waiting for an opportunity to get deeper into the aura or even into her body. It said it had come from her parents and intended to return to them if sent out of my client. It was told that that was not an option, and, reluctantly, it allowed itself to be drawn into a place so, the light but not in the light, as the condition was described to us by one of the discarnate beings assisting. Each case needs to be evaluated individually and treated according to what is felt to be the wisest approach. More will be said on this subject in the last chapter, 37 Chapter 2. During the past century, a good many religious and philosophical ideas have changed or been rejected in the landslide of the materialistic sciences. Electromagnetic and gravitational forces were studied in the so-called hard sciences, but the other types of forces, that is, mental, emotional, motivational, were neglected. When I was a medical student in the middle and late 1930s, my medical school, Tulane, was one of the very few that offered any course in psychology or psychiatry, the attitude of most schools being, Doctors take care of the body, priests, rabbis, and preachers take care of the soul. Even this remark might be uttered with a slight taint of sarcasm sometimes, implying that the work of doctors was of greater importance, for who knew whether the soul even existed? Then the tide began to turn, and one of the comments being passed around in the middle and late 1960s was, "Have you heard, the psychologists first lost their souls, and then they lost their minds, but now they are about to make up their minds that they have minds." 38. Looking back through old school books of a century ago or reading the lyrics of old hymns and popular songs, we note the casual reference to the soul. The acceptance that at death the soul takes its flight to worlds unknown, that the soul of a dying child, covered with flowers, is rising, rising. Through the ages the belief has persisted in many cultures that the disembodied consciousness or soul remains aware, and can even enter and take possession of a living person's body and dispossess that person's own mind. In a few groups this belief has been taken for granted and has persisted, while in the secular society and even in a good many religious denominations the concept of awareness after death seems to be largely ignored or disbelieved. At the funeral of a lovely young woman I heard the minister say, "If she were here, she would be happy to see all of you and your gifts of flowers." He assumed that her consciousness was far away. Perhaps it was actually present, invisibly. A good many souls when regressed to a past life death have reported staying near the body until after the funeral. Gradually in these modern times more and more therapists, especially hypnotherapists, are coming to be more open to the once common assumption that deceased psyches, discarnate entities can and sometimes do invade living persons. Sometimes the change in therapists' attitude is due to the spontaneous complaints of clients and sometimes to the suspected presence of an invading entity from various clues presented by the client, who herself may be entirely unsuspecting. When I was in high school I held the tentative belief that the gospel stories of casting out unclean spirits must be merely the biblical way of describing epileptic attacks. A considerable proportion of the Gospels is given to stories of the casting out of unclean spirits. Then, still in my teens, I heard of so-called earthbound souls who did not progress to the next dimension after death. According to what I read, these discarnate souls, many of them unaware that their bodies were dead, continued to hover in the earth plane and were drawn to other psyches similar to their own, through whose physical bodies they might FMD gratification of former habits. The books, Rosicrucian and Theosophical, also discussed elementals and other non-human entities. At that time I put most of those ideas aside with a puzzled smile and a raised eyebrow but kept the ideas on my mental neutral shelf, for future reference in case further evidence came along. By the time I began serious experimentation with hypnotic regression work in the mid-1950s I had learned the important art of not judging any idea too hastily no matter how far out it might sound. I did have occasional lapses, as, for instance, when a lovely white-haired woman, the widow of a minister and herself a lay counselor, lecturer, and healer, diagnosed my chronic fatigue in the thoughtful words, "I think this may be oppression by an evil spirit." My disappointment in her was profound. How could an intelligent, educated person like Mrs. Eggleston hold such medieval ideas? My chicken came home to roost a few years later when relatives and friends made similar comments to me, "With your scientific education, your modern training, how can you possibly believe in stuff like this?" I think that almost the same sort of change occurred in the attitude of psychiatrists and psychologists toward the concept of multiple personalities, first the doubts and questions, and later the acceptance, which caused doubts and questions in the relatives and friends. Comparison with multiple. The author's method of releasement. I try to check for entrapped entities at the first or second session with almost every chent who comes to me, with whatever complaint. I discuss with the client the possibility that her problems may not all belong to her but to some other consciousness that has been influencing her. Nearly all people would be willing to believe that some other influence is to blame for some of their troubles. but this by itself would not be sufficient reason to suspect or diagnose an obsession. In case a client may be made anxious and nervous by the very mention of a possible not self-consciousness within their own mind or body, this first little conversation, therefore, is held in a light-hearted but common-sense manner, with examples, and ending with some such remark as, "Well, in any case, if it is all right with you, I would like to check and see." Then, with the client in light to moderately deep hypnosis, the depth need not even be as deep as for most simple regressions, and telling the client that a certain finger is the yes finger, which will twitch or rise when I ask a question to which the answer from the subconscious level is yes, and also a no finger, touching the fingers as I speak, I then ask, "Is there any consciousness, any mind, any entity in this person, calling her by name, which does not belong to her, is not a part of her own being? Please answer through the fingers on the count of 3, 1, 2, 3. If the client already has a yes and a no finger, I use those instead of designating others. A few seconds may elapse before the fingers respond. The manner in which they respond is significant. A quick response means that the invading entity is eager to speak with the therapist and will probably be very cooperative. A hesitation or only a tiny twitch of the yes finger may indicate that the entity is fearful or timid, that it is not sure of what this is going to lead to. In such a case, I usually follow Dr. Baldwin's approach and assure the entity, "Don't be afraid of me. I want to help you." More assurance may be needed, especially when the entity is the soul of a person who died by betrayal and cannot trust others, such as a child who was killed by abuse. When the fingers do not move at all, I used to think the fault was in me or was just a block of some unknown type. Now I have discovered, as Baldwin did before me, that in almost every case it is because the entity does not want to be found and is trying to hide from the therapist, pretending not to be present, not permitting the yes finger to move and reveal its presence. But the truthful subconscious mind of the client will not falsely move the no finger. Therefore, neither one moves. In such an instance, I speak to the entity, "Please don't be afraid of me. I believe you are here. Is there an entity hiding from me?" This question often brings a yes movement, even if small. Then I thank the entity for letting me know of its presence, and we continue from there. When the entity is unable or unwilling to speak through the voice of the client, or the channel, much can be learned merely by asking for finger movements in answer to questions framed to be answered by a simple yes or no. Nearly all entities of whatever type can use the voice of the client or channel by placing its thoughts into the mind of the client or channel, who then speaks the thoughts aloud. If the entity believes it cannot do so or for any reason refuses to, still much can be learned through the finger movements alone. Routinely, I program each new client, with his or her consent, to go into the altered state when my voice speaks the cue words, "Rest now." This, I explain, is merely a little shortcut, a time saver which can be cancelled out at any time the chant desires. Meanwhile, it is convenient in case the client wishes to receive hypnotic assistance over the telephone. On the subconscious and superconscious levels, we are all living and dead, in close connection with one another, regardless of space and time differences. The state of altered consciousness enables one to access these other minds and become aware on a conscious level of their thoughts and feelings. Not at all complex, it seems to be very simple and natural to all who are involved, the client, the entities, and the therapist. Nested entities. The condition that Baldwin used to call piggyback obsession and now calls nesting of entities is remarkably common. Imagine that an old alcoholic who died and whose soul continued to haunt bars had been obsessed by the soul of another drinker who had died before, and who, in fact, had increased the old man's addiction and hastened his death. Then suppose that the two-in-one had managed to invade another customer in the bar, one with a strong taste for alcohol, in all probability, and obsessed him. The customer, leaving the house, might have had an irresistible urge to stop as soon as possible at another liquor store, perhaps to the person's own astonishment at feeling the sudden strength of the urge. From then on, the guest would be entertaining not only his own desire for alcohol but also the thirst of the old alcoholic plus the thirst of the other in him, the one nested in the old man. This is a sketch of the type of doubling up of entities that occurs quite easily over there, years and lifetimes. The symptoms are the same as outlined for what may be called simple obsessions, in which each invading entity has no other inside of it.